Good evening, everyone. It is truly gratifying to have such a wonderful turnout for this special evening with Jane Jacobs. My name is Brian Prince, and I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Mr. Richard Bachman. I hail from Brian Prince Bookseller, our feisty independent bookstore here in Hamilton, and Richard hails from across the bay at an equally feisty independent bookstore, but we're not feisty with each other, which is quite amazing. And I think quite unusual in today's world of commerce. And I'm going to turn the microphone over to Richard.
It was a handsome broadsheet. That's one that we have proudly hanging at a different drummer. It was a printed setting of a Spanish proverb. Books are a hindrance to persisting stupidity. So, the cure is before you.
Thank you, Richard. Dark Age Ahead is Jane Jacobs' most recent book, and has been the case with the others, it has not made a very quiet entrance. As has also been the case with her other books, it is probably not going to get around to making an exit, at least not for quite a while. Jane Jacobs' books, beginning with the publication of her 1961 masterpiece, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, tend to have staying power, in large part because they so clearly articulate what we see around us, have not had the wit to understand in a comprehensive way. With the possible exception of Rachel Carson's publication of Silent Spring, I can't think of an author or a thinker or an activist whose work has had more real impact on our real world, certainly not within the realm of urban planning and economics and politics. Jane Jacobs is one of those very rare creatures. She is someone who has made us change not only the way we think, but the way we live. In Toronto, the city in which Jane Jacobs has lived for 35 years, the city's many successes and in more recent years its many widening cracks and failures are measured to an astonishing degree against an urban scale of the very good and the very bad that she has made clear. With the exceptions of Mel Lastman and Mike Harris, and please, may they remain the exceptions, there has not been a recent politician of any influence at the municipal level who has not been affected or informed by her wisdom. Wisdom that they have sometimes digested of their own accord, and wisdom that they have sometimes have rammed down their throat by the citizens they govern. In many ways, Jane Jacobs has made a career out of saying loudly and clearly just the right thing at the right time. It is more than a little sobering to remind ourselves of how split-second her timing has been and how close we have come to making the kind of monumental mistakes that she has railed against. At the time that she moved to Toronto from New York, and at the time her thoughts began to find resonance in the corridors of municipal power, major demolitions were already in the works in Toronto, and it's almost unimaginable today to recall what they were. The old City Hall, Union Station, St. Lawrence Market, whole tracts of thriving, lively downtown neighborhoods. The Spadina Expressway was in the wings, as was a Crosstown Expressway, as was the Scarborough Expressway. Jane Jacobs did not stop these oncoming errors herself, of course, but it was her thinking that in many, many respects provided the intellectual backbone to what distressed and angry citizens knew in an intuitive way, but had not been able to argue as clearly, as forcefully, as convincingly, and as authoritatively as did Jane Jacobs. She reminded us that bureaucrats, politicians, planners, and so-called experts were not only capable of making mistakes, they often functioned within so limited and self-referential a context that mistakes were all but inevitable. As someone who grew up in this city and who can remember a once thriving, once attractive, once unique downtown core, I cannot resist pointing out that the force and reality of Jane Jacobs' ideas are often more apparent, more painfully obvious, in the cities that pushed ahead with the nonsense she argued against than in the cities that were wise enough, or maybe just lucky enough, to begin to pay attention to what she had to say. And so once again, Jane Jacobs has arrived in the nick of time, or perhaps not, for the title Dark Age Ahead does not seem to indicate that she is overly optimistic about our prospects. But it is, indeed, a hopeful book. And if not in the nick of time, certainly she has arrived with her customary impeccable timing. Because my sense of the reaction thus far to Dark Age Coming is that people are in some ways astonished to encounter it here now, just when people were beginning to think in a serious, concrete way that we are going to hell in a handbasket, along comes Jane Jacobs to tell us, A, how it is that we have embarked on this unfortunate downward spiral, and B, what we can do to pull ourselves out of it. In summary of Dark Age Coming, I'd like to quote from an article the journalist Michael Volpe wrote recently in the Canadian Literary Review. He said, five stabilizing pillars of North American society, Jacobs writes, are becoming irrelevant, are dangerously close to the brink of lost memory and cultural uselessness. Those pillars are community and family, higher education, the effective practice of science and technology, the regimen of taxes and government powers directly in touch with needs and possibilities, and self-policing by the learned professions. Shortly, we will open onto the floor the questions that you may wish to put to Jane Jacobs. But first, I have a few questions of my own. And so, with your permission, and Jane, with your permission, I'd like to begin by asking about the idea of a dark age. It seems to me interesting to wonder how it is that a vibrant and thriving culture can forget itself in such a way that it can enter into a dark age.
It seemed very odd to me, too, because we're well aware how attached people are to their cultures. They defend them, they are proud of them. Think of the fights that go on about language, which, of course, is an important part of culture. Why would people willingly seem to forget their cultures and stop handing them down? Because that's what happens in the Dark Age. One of the things that happens, anyway, a dark age, in effect, is a dead end of a culture. Very sad thing. And I believe that is what happens in the mass amnesia part of a dark age. That's why it's forgotten. It isn't used anymore. This is true of the famous dark age that followed the collapse of the Roman Empire. Amazing loss of knowledge and interest in what the people used to do. That's how the classical age disappeared and never again revived as a living way of being. But it's also what has happened to the many Aboriginal cultures in North America that were conquered, and the pillars that they depended on taken from them and no longer used, like the lands that sustained them, the ways of hunting and foraging and dressing and crafts and their religions. Very, very similar to the European famous Dark Age.
Next speaker, go ahead. My name is Glenn Atwell. I live in the city of Hamilton. My family has lived in Canada longer than there's been a Canada, lived in America longer than there's been in America. I'm a person with Native ancestors, and I've been active in the valley in Hamilton to protect that area. I'd like to read the small submission to your group. Dear Greenbelt Committee, should the Greenbelt policy unfold as I see written, it will lead to conflicting positions with the First Nations. There are serious cultural differences that need to be addressed, or those small issues will boil into larger issues in the near future, nearer rather than further off. We are facing one of these conflicts here in the city. The entire Greenbelt is within the boundaries of nations that existed before Confederation, and these nations still exist in the Greenbelt area. The area is also on the edge of Canada's most populated areas, and they contain the largest number of First Nations peoples within the cities themselves. The Greenbelt contains many heritage and culturally sensitive areas, some discovered and others still hidden. There are serious, profound constitutional issues around land use and heritage hunting rates. Many issues deal with international treaties that fall outside the mandate of provincial legislation that need to be observed. The cooperative arrangements need to include respect and regard for different cultural values. Consultation needs to be a two-way street. Accountability is a mandate. The enforcement of the Act needs to be fair and across board. It has to be open, transparent process. No backroom deals means a trusted process. We need a non-obligation amendment for the First Nations. There should be no requirement for the nations to sign the agreement. This needs to be the role of a respectful policy mandates based on consent without infringing on treaty rights. An informal arrangement between nations needs to be public and renewed often at gatherings, and people must participate in the decision-making included in the discussions. Natives should be trained as Greenbelt conservation officers to report and observe the mandate of the Act. The role of officers requires training and support from the province. Priority should be given to those officers within the boundaries of their specific national character, with Central Bureau to keep trained high-level standard across board. That is because we have many Native nations within that entire region, and they're all different, and they all need to be respected. Because some issues are being discussed across the road about the use of the escarpment as we presently speak, some agreements are supposed to be reviewed at this particular time. By these parties signing this agreement, they're also signing away the treaty rights of land that have no jurisdictional right to do so based on both traditional laws, acts of the Crown, or lack of proper representation, or their rights thereof. To construct a highway through Red Hill Creek Valley along the creek bed, relocation, and blasting the escarpment. I ask the committee to include the First Nations in your mandate and to take their concerns seriously. Thank you very much.
In some cases of a dark age, the losers are unable to practice what they did in the past or retain it because the foundations of it have been taken from them. By conquest, usually.
Well, the purpose of today is, number one, showing support for our brothers and sisters that are up in the trees up near the blast zone there, and to hopefully put another wrench in the gears of the machine that is rolling forward and destroying our beautiful East End Valley. And again, just to further reiterate to Mr. Deaney and council that they do not have the majority of people's interest in mind when being down here and doing this expressway. Mr. Deaney has less than 20% of the people of Hamilton voting for him, so by no means does he have a majority. And I just want to further reiterate a lot of the points that are still of major concern to Hamiltonians. 50% of Hamilton's social housing is within 1 kilometer of this expressway. The valley itself was a huge lung for the East End of Hamilton, where we have some of the highest asthma rates in the country, and Hamilton's air quality is increasingly getting worse and worse every year, especially downwind from the steel mills, and by putting in this expressway, it's going to make the air quality so poor that scientists have said that children and the elderly will not be able to enjoy the valley in its present state, especially with the expressway in. I was also calling this because I declined interviews with the Spectator earlier just because of my issues with the corporate media at large. And their handling of this this situation and the obvious bias towards Deaney and the campaign when that was all going on. And I won the award of the Environmentalist of the Year, and I just wanted to let people know what I've been through to get such a moniker put to my name. I've been surveilled by the police for a number of months. There was a fella that was videotaping me yesterday as well. On May the 1st, there was police that were following around people from a Red Hill Valley coalition as well. I was arrested twice, thrown in jail for a night. Of 24 people that were arrested, there was 20 charges dropped. I'm pretty sure I'm accurate on those stats. And this is how we treat environmentalists and anybody with a voice of dissent that is standing up for the common good and the good of our communities. And this road is a typical example of big business and the political elites pushing their agenda on the wills of communities and all across the world, really, and the power structures that be. And this road goes right up to the top of the political elites in this country. Paul Martin and his CSL ships, a lot of the coal and stuff is coming right into Hamilton Harbor, and a lot of his holdings and a lot of the money that is made from his company is a lot of said and done here in Hamilton. As well as the Magnus Steel, which is owned by the Stronach family, which is one of the top funders of the Conservative Party as well. And they also have a lot of interest here in this road. And I'm just here to say that, no, we are here for the community, and I represent a growing number of people that recognize the degradation of our environment and the breaking down of our communities at the hands of big developers and private interest companies.
So you're tying Paul Martin directly into this expressway in some way.
Well, he definitely has a big interest in this expressway and roads like this, and really it's an extension of the NAFTA superhighway and these big trade deals, which I don't recall ever having any kind of vote on when the NAFTA was put through. The Conservatives did not get majority of the vote that year either, and there's a fundamental problem with the way that our electoral politics works in this country as well.
What about the tree sitters that are now off the ground on the other end of the valley?
Yeah, hats off to them. They're just totally amazing, and they have all my support. And yeah, hopefully we'll be able to really pull the community together, because I know that a lot of people in this city are against this expressway, and a lot of people just don't know a lot of the politics behind it. But hopefully we'll be able to mobilize once again, because the expressway isn't here, and we're not going to go away. And
I understand blasting is supposed to be starting very soon. Do you happen to know when it is?
I have no idea. The city wants to keep that as hush as they possibly can.
But isn't that why the tree sitters chose the spot they did, that they could be right in the line of the blasting and the hydro towers?
I can't speak for the tree sitters, but I'm sure that was one of the major decisions in why they chose the spot that they did.
Any idea how long they can hold out up there?
It depends who the city of Hamilton wants to bring in to deal with the situation, but they'll have the support of me and my cohorts and friends and brothers and sisters from Hamilton, I'm sure, as long as they're up there.
We've been talking to Kevin Hamilton, the original tree sitter in the Red Hill Valley. Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome.
It's even more mysterious and just as final in the case of Dark Ages, that our loss to rot from within, not from conquest by outsiders, stronger outsiders. The losses from interior rot are probably harder to climb out of. Although I wouldn't say that categorically, I'm not sure enough about that point. But they're hard to climb out of anyway. There's been some progress in learning what this interior rot is and how it happens. Some of it only in very recent years. Those of you who have read the brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning book Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond will recall that he has quite a theory and a lot of information about what makes losers and what makes winners in these cases. And he is very clear about the internal rot that occurs. This differs, of course, depending on what period of history is being handled and or the qualities of the culture while it was alive. Like the conflict and disagreement about the road to your park.
I'm afraid it's going to be very difficult to conduct the business of council. And this is a public hall. We want people to be in here, but they need to be respectful of the protocol to allow council to do its work. I would really. Okay, all right.
What happens is some land developer, who happens to be a friend or a relative of the mayor, just happens to be, decides they want to develop a subdivision out on beautiful farmland, some of the best in the world. And what they do is the city has a plan called Vision 2020, and they're supposed to be thinking about the future and the environment. They're not supposed to expand the city boundaries. They're supposed to keep it in. But every time a friend of the mayor comes, a land developer, the people who pay for the mayor's $330,000 election campaign, they come up and knock on Larry's door and say, "Larry, remember who's paying your election campaign expenses? We are."
Something is blocking some of the feedback, whether it's bribery, which is of some kind or other, which is not always money, or barriers set up to part of the feedback. Something or other is going wrong there. When it goes on for years, it's worth thinking about and examining and debating in the open as much as possible. I take it that has failed in Hamilton. And far from it being debated openly now, it's considered to be decided and not worth thinking or talking about much anymore. Well, that's behind you. Well, you'll see in the future whether it's behind you or not. People who don't heed feedback they find out in very sad ways the penalties for that. Dark Ages, which is one reason I wrote this book, are terrible ordeals. I wouldn't wish them on any culture or on any people. It's a miserable way to live.
We have a development. We want you to extend the city boundary. And Larry says, okay, okay. And what they do is they buy 500 acres. And the environmentalists came and said, no, you can't expand the boundary.
Still Indian land.
They got the OMB to do that. They are building a road. The Red Hill Expressway is a road to open up development for these land developers. How does that have to do with the budget? The budget, there's only a limited amount of dollars they can squeeze out of the taxpayer. And so, instead of taking that money and spending it on affordable housing, on library hours, opening up the recreation centers they've closed on the weekend, instead of revitalizing the core, instead of fixing the streets that are falling apart, where do they put the money? They put it into the expressway. They put it in their expressway, and everything else in the city suffers. We are heading towards a bankruptcy situation, and all of this is done for the mantra of economic development. There's only one group's economic development that's going to develop out of this budget, and that's Larry Deani and some of these aldermen's land developer and speculator friends. And I say, that's not right. That money should go to mass transit. Is that right?
Yes.
Should that money be allocated to keeping city workers on the job and expanding services? Should that money be put into mass transit instead of an expressway? Should that money go to alternate means of transportation like bike lanes? Should that money go to tree planting programs instead of those $250,000 homes they're going to build on that farmland I was telling you about? Should it go to affordable housing for people who are living on it? Brothers and sisters, these people here are living in a dream world, and it's only when real people come here and tell them how they should be acting that they start to wake up. So I hope that from now on, you people will make sure that you stay apprised of the situation that's going on, and that you work in order to get rid of the people here who are here because the land developers pay their election expenses every time. Not cheap election expenses. It's $25,000, $30,000 that we know about. And in Larry Deani's case, $330,000. That's a lot of money. So, my point, ladies and gentlemen, is from now on, don't let them live here in this dream world thinking that they can run things without any flack and our money.
This city is not going to privatize our water. It's going to an American water company. We have a right to have access, affordable water, public service, not where we're paying and paying and paying. Where is this money? Where is it going? And they won't even be accountable about the contract, what's happening. There's no accountability.
You have stated your point of view. You've had your say for a fair amount of time now. I'm going to ask you on behalf of the democracy that you are saying you want to uphold, I'm going to ask you to please leave, take your seats in a quiet way, and will just allow us to carry on with the meeting. We're almost done with the meeting. I'm asking you to do that, please. And if you don't do that, then I'm going to ask the police to help out. Okay? So please.
To Gord Poehler, who's at location at the Mount Albion part of the Red Hill Valley, and what's going on there right now, Gord?
There are three people living on platforms in trees very close to the Niagara Escarpment, which is the city of Hamilton is proposing to blast to make way for the Red Hill Expressway. And their intent is to stop the blasting of the escarpment.
So they're in trees that are left right at Mount Albion Road, which I guess is right where the blasting is going to start. How long are they able to stay in these platforms?
I believe they're equipped to stay there for quite a long time.
Okay.
Weeks.
So they're inside the injunction zone. They're right in the area of blasting. There's three of them in trees. I guess how many feet off the ground are they? Do you know?
I would say they're about 50, 60 feet up.
Okay, so they're 50 feet off the ground in platforms. Are these the present tree sitters? Are they on a better platform than Mr. Hamilton was on?
They're very sturdy, and they had help from professional climbers to establish themselves up there.
Okay.
Well, they moved in during the night, Saturday night, and set up their platforms, and they're presently up there making themselves at home.
Did you get a statement from any of these tree climbers, Gord, before you got a chance?
I can read it if you'd like to hear it.
Sure, I'd like to hear what they had to say.
We are here today to remind developers, city councilors, and every Hamiltonian, Ontarian, and Canadian that it is not too late to end the destruction. There are affordable alternatives. We are here today because an irreparable hole 80 meters wide and 15 meters deep is about to be blasted into the Niagara Escarpment. This action will disrupt the delicate ecosystem that exists in the Red Hill Valley even more so than has the recent tree cutting. Tree cutting that was initiated days before an election, a political statement and an insult to democracy. It took place despite ongoing negotiations between the City of Hamilton and Six Nations representatives. We are here today to remind developers, city councilors, and every Hamiltonian, Ontarian, and Canadian that it is not too late to end the destruction. There are affordable alternatives. We have not forgotten about Red Hill Valley, and we never will.